Previously, strong instruments erected to quantify wind speed were toppled in 30 minutes. All commercial flights were instructed to give the area a wide berth, and all nearby ski resorts were closed. The Raton Pass had endured 5 winter storms already, and the snow packed on the mountains was kept there by freezing temperatures and the weight of the snow itself. When the current storm finally came crashing down, 2 things happened. The temperatures actually rose a few degrees, and the new snow fell so heavily and so fast that it didn't simply settle on top of the snow below. It hit and then slid, with more snow falling and tumbling right behind it. Thus, tremendous momentum was built up in a very short time. By 7 o'clock, conditions were near whiteout. Then at 9:30, there was a sudden lull in the storm, and the forecasters predicted the system had exhausted itself and would rapidly dissipate, with a change in the prevailing winds now directing the worst of it north and east. Someone once said to Mark Twain, upon the occasion of a sudden rain shower, that he hoped the storm would stop, whereupon Twain had replied that the odds were good, because it always had. He'd also remarked that weather in general was very accommodating. If one didn't like what it was doing at any given moment, all one had to do was wait a bit, and the weather would change. Twain had never put much stock in weather predicting, no doubt sensibly concluding that the science of foretelling what Mother Nature intended was a sorry one at best, and a fool's gamble at worst. Well, some things hadn't changed, because even with satellites and super Doppler radar and other state-of-the-art devices to help them, the meteorologists following the current storm did what meteorologists often do. They got it wrong. The blizzard had been merely resting. Now millions of tons of Pacific moisture and gale-like winds were perfectly poised to add one to the history books. Chapter 27. Most of the wedding partygoers had dispersed by now, but Max and Misty, Cristobal and Lelia, and Herrick Higgins were all sitting in the lounge car. Tom and Eleanor had left separately right after Roxanne had finished singing, and they hadn't been seen since. Roxanne had gone to take care of train business and get the choir settled back down after their hard work. Married now, Steve and Julie had been given an empty double deluxe in which to officially commence their honeymoon with, no doubt, considerable gusto. The chief was now well past Trinidad, Colorado, and had its sights set squarely on the Raton Pass. Everyone watched as the train started its ascent. As the grade grew steeper and the deep whine of the 3 engines grew louder, there was a creeping uneasiness among the passengers. The vast amounts of snow being pushed off the track by the lead engine's plow could be seen at every curve. It was a wonder that the engineer could see it all with all that white flying around. Cristobal said, what happens if one of the cars comes loose? Do we just go barreling down into the abyss? Higgins replied, no, the automatic braking system comes on and the car stops. Train technology has come a long way over the years. He pointed out the window. We'll climb to 7,580 feet at the highest point.
That's pretty high, said Cristobal.
Well, it's not the highest track elevation in this country. That's on the California Zephyr past Denver at a little over 9,200 feet. In South America, I forget which country, there's a train track at an elevation so high that they have to give out oxygen to the passengers. We go through a half-mile-long tunnel that runs under the pass, and once we get out of that, we're in New Mexico. We'll descend down the eastern side of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains and into Raton. Raton's at an elevation of 6,666 feet, so while the descent is sharp, it's not really that far.
Misty looked stricken, and she grabbed Max's arm. Did you say 6,666 feet?
Higgins looked at her over the rim of his coffee cup.
Yes, ma'am.
Are you sure that's the elevation? Exactly?
Well, yes, ma'am. They measure those things pretty precisely.
Oh, my God, said Misty.
What's wrong, honey? Asked Max.
Don't you see? 6666? It's the worst possible combination of numbers. It's even worse than a 666.
Max turned pale.
You're right. The mark of the devil plus another 6. Totally bad karma.
Is this really a problem?
asked a nervous-looking Cristobal.
"In my line of business, it doesn't get much worse," said Misty emphatically. "Can we stop the train?"
"Isn't there a brake rope to pull like in the movies?"
asked Lelia. She was seated next to Cristobal and was anxiously clutching his arm.
No, they don't have those anymore," said Higgins. "Now just calm down, it'll be okay. The chief runs this route twice a day east and west." He checked his watch. "We'll be entering the tunnel pretty soon."
"Is it dark?"
Cristobal wanted to know.
"Well, most tunnels are, son," replied Higgins judiciously. "But we won't be in it long. In and out in a blink, and then on to Raton and New Mexico."
Tom eyed the diamond ring in his hand. It had belonged to his mother, and ever since her death, he'd carried it with him. In fact, he'd very nearly pulled this ring out and handed it to Steve instead of the one he was supposed to. In turn, that bit of confusion had also led him to start toward Eleanor with the band of gold, rather than merely handing it to Steve to place on Julie's finger. He pocketed the ring, examined himself in the mirror, smoothed down a few stray hairs, adjusted the tie that Cristobal had loaned him for the wedding ceremony, took a long breath, and told himself for the 100th time that this was what he had to do. A few minutes later, he knocked on Eleanor's compartment door. She slid back the curtain, stared at him, then drew the curtain back, and he heard the door lock click into place. He rapped on the glass again.
"Ellie, I really need to talk to you right now."
"Go away."
"I need to ask you something, and I'm going to ask you right now."
She flung the door open so hard, metal plunked hard on metal.
"I thought I'd made myself more than perfectly clear."
Tom reached into his pocket for the ring and started to shakily descend to his knees. The interior of the train was thrown into darkness as the chief entered the tunnel. The next events happened with terrifying suddenness. All of the snow covering the southern crest of the mountain closest to the train tracks broke loose from the overpowering strength of relentless wind gusts and the tons of new fallen snow. Officially, the avalanche started at 11:15 mountain time, and it raced down the mountainside at tremendous speed. It was enough snow that if it were melted, it would have formed a decent-sized lake of considerable depth. The avalanche hit the slide fences, located between the mountain slope and the train tracks, which had been installed there for the very purpose of detecting track intrusions. The impact occurred with such force that it not only flattened the steel fence, but also ripped it off its supports and carried it down the mountain. This collision sent an automatic red alert to Amtrak dispatch that in turn instantly communicated to the engineer of the Southwest Chief to stop the train dead in its tracks pending further developments. The chief had just emerged from the tunnel under the Raton Pass when the signal was given, and the engineer applied the brakes with the swiftness that the gravity of the situation required. Indeed, he didn't need the warning by Amtrak dispatch, because he could see the awesome spectacle clearly through his windshield, though it was a considerable distance up the track. So powerful was the tidal wave of snow and rock that it spread out laterally, and a substantial tributary headed dead at the chief, with enough potential lethality to cause the engineer who'd been running this route for 14 years to whisper a quick goodbye to his wife and kids. He'd seen many things during his railroad career, but nothing that came close to what was presently bearing down on him and his train. He closed his eyes, because all he could envision happening in the next few seconds was the utter destruction of the Southwest Chief and all those on board. As the train lurched to a halt, everyone sensed that this wasn't a normal stop. When the idling train began to shake as though an earthquake were occurring, they became sure of it. Thankfully, they couldn't see what the engineer could, but they all heard a growing rumble that was immediately identifiable to several people on board who'd heard such sounds before.
"It's an avalanche!"
shouted Tom as he looked out the window. Eleanor paled.
"My God!"
He ripped a mattress off the bed, grabbed Eleanor, threw her on the floor, put the mattress on top of her, and then covered the mattress with his body as the train continued to shake and gyrate, and the sounds of the mountain's snowy skin sliding off became deafening. Back in the lounge car, everyone was under the tables. Some scribbled last will and testaments on napkins. Others stumbled through long-forgotten prayers. Max and Misty clung to each other, and Lelia and Cristobal did the same, his long arms wrapped protectively around her. Higgins was under the table, too, but he was looking out the window still, his worst fears realized with sudden ferocity. Miraculously, the enormous sideways thrust of the hurtling snow stopped before it knocked the train off the track. However, when the engineer finally opened his eyes, the only thing he saw was an impenetrable wall of snow. He managed to report into Amtrak and was told that presumably a second avalanche on the other side of the tunnel had taken another slide fence with it. A minute or two either early or late, and the chief would be at the bottom of a ravine, not a single person on board having to worry further about the upcoming holiday. Yes, lucky indeed, the engineer was told by Amtrak dispatch, though he'd seen that for himself. On the other hand, the chief was now sandwiched in, unable to go either forward or back, and the storm apparently was just getting started. The meteorologist now weighed in with an updated forecast, an accurate one this time. The region was being blasted by a winter storm, the likes of which hadn't been seen in 30 years. The old storm had claimed over 600 lives, with some people, cut off from every known point of civilization, having died of starvation. They were folks in remote, inaccessible areas, precisely like the one in which the chief was now idling helplessly. Higgins looked to the sky as high winds began to sweep off the mountain and buffet the chief with such power that the enormously heavy train was rocking back and forth at unsettling angles. In all his years working the rails, he'd never been in a position quite like this. Looking out the left side window, no one could fail to see that it was a long way down. With the snow continuing to fall, another avalanche couldn't be ruled out. And the next one just might take the Southwest chief with it. Chapter 28. An hour later, Roxanne issued a formal announcement over the train's PA system, telling people what had happened and what was being done to help the trapped train. The latter was fairly meager, since there wasn't a whole lot that could be done right now. As she explained, with twin mountains of snow blocking both the way to L.A. and the rails back to Chicago, the chief squarely in the middle, and a blizzard hammering the region with high winds and snow, the best that could be done right now was for people to remain calm and in their compartments. It wasn't an easy instruction to follow, and the corridors were constantly filled with anxious folks seeking more detailed information. Herrick Higgins had gone up to speak with the engineer and come back with an even more worried look. Tom and Eleanor had joined Misty and Max in the lounge car, where they alternated between staring out of the window at a sheet of white snow, tensing with each slam of wind against the walls of the train, and occasionally peering out at the 200-foot drop off the left side of the train. Lelia had discreetly retired to her compartment with her new compatriot, Cristobal.
"I knew this was going to happen," said Misty. "Four sixes. How could it not happen?"
"Well, I've been doing this for a long time," said Higgins, "and it's never happened before. Train travel is the safest way there is to get around, even safer than a plane if you look at the numbers."
"Could there be another avalanche?" asked Misty. "One that hits the train?"
"It's Mother Nature," he replied, "so anything's possible. But I think with two avalanches already, most of the snow that's going to come down already did."
Tom looked at the old railroader.
"So what now? How do they get to us? We can't exactly wait for the spring thaw." "No, we can't. But getting to us is a little difficult. The freight company that owns these tracks is a good one, with lots of resources, but with the track blocked by all that snow and the weather the way it is, there's not much they can do. These are tight quarters here, not a lot of room to maneuver, and there's really no place for a small plane or helicopter to land, even if the weather settled down."
"Well, that's comforting," said Max.
Roxanne came up looking exhausted. She'd been everywhere in the last hour or so, calming passengers, consoling the boys' choir, making sure that all the things that could still be done on the train to make people more comfortable were done. She sat down and caught her breath.
Well, on top of all this, it seems that the crook that hit the cap got on board the chief. A bunch of people have reported items missing.
Max shook his head.
This is truly amazing.
He and Misty exchanged glances.
The good thing, said Higgins, is that we added the third engine at La Junta, so we have an extra power plant to help us through.
Roxanne nodded at this.
What do you mean? Asked Max. The electrical power that keeps the lights, heat, etc. going comes from electrical generators in the engines, generators powered by the diesel fuel engines, head-end power, it's called.
So when we run out of fuel, we run out of electricity, said Tom.
That's right. But with an extra engine gives us more time.
How much more time? Asked Max.
Hard to say. We took on extra fuel in Kansas, but the chief refuels at Albuquerque, about 250 miles from here.
And it took a lot of fuel to climb the pass, so the diesel tanks aren't exactly full, said Tom. Higgins nodded. So we could be talking hours here, couldn't we, before the power goes?
Well, the engineer's doing all he can to conserve fuel.
Can't we put all the passengers in a few cars and cut off power to the others? Suggested Max.
No, the system doesn't work that way. The engines generate true hotel-like power, and whether they're heating 3 cars or 10, it's the same fuel consumption. Now, when I went to see the engineer, we did come up with a strategy. He's alternating among the 3 locomotives, putting one and then another in standby mode, which is the setting for supplying electrical power while standing still. That balances fuel supply among the units and conserves fuel, because the units not in standby mode are placed in slow idle and fuel burn is minimal.
Why not just turn some of the engines off? Asked Eleanor.
That burns too much fuel to get them started again, said Roxanne.
Higgins nodded and said,
And the other problem is that trains don't carry antifreeze in their coolant system because it takes too much water. You have to keep the engines idling to prevent the pipes from freezing. In weather this cold, once you turn off the head-end power and the heat fails, you have less than an hour before the pipes start freezing. Then you have no water for food preparation, drinking, sanitary requirements.
I'm glad we put on extra food in KC, said Roxanne. We'll start rationing right now because we have no idea how long we'll be here.
She rose to go back to work.
If I need help, I'm sure I can count on all of you, right?
They all nodded back. She smiled bravely and trudged off. 4 hours later, it grew dark. Most people had returned to their compartments and covered themselves with blankets and were now contemplating their possible demise. Tom stopped in on Father Kelly, who was reading his Bible.
You know, you might want to lead a service on the train, Father, to lift people's spirits.
The priest said,
But not everyone's Catholic.
Tom looked out the window where the snow was still coming down and the wind was still slamming into them.
I'm not sure it really matters right now.
I'm a little rusty, I'm afraid.
It's like riding a bike. You never really forget how to do it.
Tom found Max and Misty cuddled together in the double deluxe. Misty was still depressed, but Max had regained his jocularity, even with his missing pair of Bruno Mollies.
Figure the person who took them needs them more than me. That's generous of you, said Tom. I got way too much stuff as it is, but I have to tell you, with everything that's happened, this will make a great movie if I just live through it to actually film it.
Max, scolded Misty.
Always figured I'd go out in some enormous bang of a thing. Never thought I'd be on a train, though.
Thanks, Max. That's very encouraging, she said.
Ah, come on, Misty. It's all written in the stars. Tell me, what's your prediction? What do the cards tell you?
Max, not now.
Are you telling me one little disaster is going to turn you from everything you believe in? That's pretty wimpy faith.
Misty sighed, pulled out her tarot cards, started shuffling them, and then began laying them out one at a time. At first she seemed totally uninterested in the process, glancing anxiously out the window with each mighty rumble of wind. But as she kept turning the cards over, she started focusing, and a deep frown creased her forehead. Finally she said,
That's funny.
What is? Asked Tom.
Well, apparently we're going to be rescued.
That's good news, said Max. How?
Well, by something with 6 legs, that's how.
Six legs, said an incredulous Tom.
Six again. That makes five sixes. Isn't that worse than four sixes? Asked Max.
No, it says six legs here and rescued. I'll take it if I can get it, said Misty.
Max rose and went to the bar in the corner.
Well, until six legs come, I need another bourbon. You drinking with us, Tom?
Maybe later. I've got things to do.
Like what?
Like finding something with six legs, that's what.
The story of the trapped train hit all the national and international newswires, and the world awaited further developments. Unfortunately, even with all the manpower and resources of the United States ready to save the train, an uncooperative Mother Nature had different plans. No plane within range could take off in this weather, and even if it could, it had nowhere to land. Choppers were also grounded. Everyone was simply waiting for the weather to clear. And since the train still had fuel, heat, and provisions, the situation, while serious, was not life-threatening, and the urgency wasn't what it might be. Sit tight, they were told, and help would eventually get to them. However, back at Amtrak HQ, rescue preparations were at full throttle. Developments were occurring quickly. Communications had been set up with the freight company that owned the track the chief was sitting on, and the two organizations were jointly mapping out a strategy that would be executed when the weather abated. Calls had also gone out around the country for the equipment and the manpower that would undoubtedly be needed to clear the tracks. Folks at Amtrak were dubious that they'd get much of a response, it being so near Christmas. In the All Points message that went out, however, someone had been alert enough to include the fact that Roxanne Jordan and the recently retired Herrick Higgins were on board the chief. Within hours, thousands of calls and emails started flowing in from train personnel all over the country, volunteering their services and giving up their Christmases to help. Amtrak now had the manpower, and the equipment would become available shortly. Yet there was little they could do about the weather, which seemed to just keep getting worse. Chapter 29. The darkness grew deeper outside. The only sounds, those of the wind and the snow falling against the roof and tinkling against the windows. Rest wasn't easy for anyone. With every little creak, people did not see images of sugar plum fairies and a fat man and his reindeer, but rather envisioned the violent end of their lives. There was another problem besides fuel and food running low. Thankfully, no passenger was aware of it, though the train people and Higgins certainly were. It concerned the snow buildup on the tops of the train cars. The weight was tremendous, and while the cars were well built, they had their limits, and tons of snow piling on top severely tested those limits. The wind helped them, since it continually blew the accumulated snow off the cars. Yet the falling snow more than kept pace, and quickly replaced the amounts blown away by the wind. Most people chose not to eat in the dining car, preferring to stay in their rooms and either snack or not eat at all, but rather stare out the window helplessly. That helped with the food supply burn rate, but at some point, people would have to eat, and the chief only had food for about another day or so. Roxanne had sent a team of men out to check under the train cars for freezing pipes. There were none as yet, they reported back. The men had been dressed in layers of clothing, yet when they came back in from such a short period outside, they were covered with snow and shivering uncontrollably. The fuel problem was even worse. Higgins explained the situation to Tom and Eleanor as they quietly ate their dinner in the dining car.
Once the fuel runs out, we have lots of problems that will rapidly get worse. No water, pipes bursting, no heat.
And if we do run out of fuel, even if they reach us, how can the train move? It's not like the Air Force where they can refuel a plane in the air, said Tom.
Well, they'll attach engines with full tanks to the chief and pull her along, but like you said, they have to get to us first. I went up into the lead engine and I saw how much snow is piled across the tracks up ahead, and it's a lot. It'll take a while to clear that.
So maybe instead of waiting for help to get to us, we need to get to help.
Where?
Asked Eleanor.
Look around, Tom. We're in the middle of nowhere.
Any ideas on that score, Herrick? Asked Tom. You probably know the Amtrak route system as well as anyone.
Higgins thought about this for a bit.
Well, there's actually an interstate highway, I-25, that runs parallel to the pass between Raton and Trinidad and then veers north to Denver.
A highway, that's something, said Tom. We get to a car, that car gets us to help.
Only they shut it down because of the storm, said Higgins.
Okay, what else?
The veteran railroad man thought a bit more and then finally shook his head.
No, that wouldn't work.
What? Say it.
It wouldn't work, he insisted.
Herrick, right now I'll take the craziest idea you have. Maybe we can make it work.
Higgins shrugged and hunched forward.
There's a resort near here in the mountains. It's a ski resort in the winter and then a dude ranch in the summer called the Dingo. It's only been in business a few years, but it's a big place and very well equipped and organized with lots of manpower. I went there a few times with my sons and their families and met the owners, a couple of transplanted Aussies who made a fortune on Wall Street and headed west for fun and something different. Problem is, you have to travel over some pretty rough terrain to get there, maybe a 4-hour hike. It can be done by people in good physical shape in fair weather, but it would be impossible on foot in this storm.
Tom stared at him.
But not on skis.
You have skis? Asked Higgins.
I was going to Tahoe for Christmas. I've also got every conceivable sort of outerwear, boots, gloves, flares, compass, helmet light, you name it.
It's really rough terrain, Tom.
I've skied just about everything there is, Herrick, in all sorts of conditions. All I need from you is what direction and anything else you can tell me about the lay of the land.
Do you really think you can manage it? Asked Higgins.
I can promise you my best shot, that's all. And what do we have to lose?
How about your life? Eleanor said.
Well, it's my life, isn't it? It's not like I've got anyone to mourn me. On that, Eleanor got up and left.
Higgins quickly gathered together the conductor, Roxanne, and the train engineer in the dining car with Tom to discuss it further. Neither the engineer nor the conductor liked the plan at all.
The conductor said, "He's a passenger, and while I appreciate the offer, Tom, I really do, if anything happens to you, it'll be my responsibility. I can't let you go. We just need to sit tight, and help will come."
"Can you get Amtrak Central on the communications phone? Or maybe we can contact the owners at the Dingo and they can send someone here,"
Higgins said to the engineer.
The man shook his head.
"The storms disrupted the signals. My last call into Central was hours ago. Haven't been able to get him on the horn since."
Roxanne added,
"We've even tried all the cell phones on the train. Nobody's got any signal strength. We can't reach Central, the resort, or anybody else. Might as well be in the Stone Age."
"Look," said Tom, "I'm not going to just sit here and let this storm devour us. I'll sign any waiver you want, absolving you of all liability in case something happens to me. I had to sign one when I was reporting overseas. I'm a big boy. I'm used to taking care of myself."
"It's not just that, Tom," said Roxanne. "We don't want anything to happen to you, honey. It's not exactly a walk in the park outside right now."
"I've been in worse conditions, Roxanne, trust me." He gazed at each of them.
"Just let me try, that's all I ask. If I can't get through, I'll come back. Simple as that."
They all looked at each other, and finally the conductor and the engineer slowly nodded.
"Okay."
Tom went to the baggage car with Roxanne and retrieved his ski equipment. Back at his compartment, he was readying things when he felt someone behind him. It was Eleanor.
"I'm just getting ready," he said quietly.
"I see." She just stood there.
"Is there something you want? I'm kind of busy here."
"I don't want you to go."
"Okay, stop right there. I'm going."
"I guess you think you're going to save the train and everybody on it."
He looked up sharply. "Yeah, that's the general plan. No need to thank me for being a hero."
She came forward and perched on the edge of the seat. "Don't you think you might be running away instead?"
"I'm going out in a blizzard and risking my life to get help, and you're calling me a coward. Thanks a hell of a lot."
Eleanor didn't shrink from this verbal attack. "Do you really want to know why I left you in Tel Aviv? Maybe you should hear it, since you might not be coming back." He looked at her a long moment, and then he sat down too.
"Well, I have to say your timing is as bad as mine, but sure, lay it on me."
She took a moment to compose herself and then said, "You're a loner, Tom, and that's how you like it. You're responsible for yourself only, no one else." He started to erupt, but she froze him with a look. "I've been waiting years to say this, and I'm going to say it, and you're going to listen." She paused and continued. "I loved you, Tom, with everything I had. I loved you. You had me totally and completely."
"Had you, past tense."
"Don't you realize that just while we were together, you were kidnapped once, imprisoned, and almost killed three times? You kept taking those crazy risks for the next story, and you never thought about what that was doing to me. Every time you went out the door, I didn't know if you were coming back. Didn't you notice I was doing less and less reporting and more worrying? I just wanted to go home. I wanted one place where you and I could stay and be together. I didn't want to get on another plane. I didn't want to watch you go on another assignment, wondering if I'd ever see you again. After all those years of wandering, I wanted a white picket fence, a backyard garden, and a husband who left at 9 and came home at 5. Only you never asked. I guess the wandering was more important to you than I was.
You gave me an ultimatum, Ellie. You gave me a few minutes to make a life-altering decision.
No, I didn't. I'd been asking you for years. You just didn't want to hear it. When I came back that morning and told you I wanted to leave, it wasn't spontaneous. It took me weeks to work up the nerve. I went out for a walk to finally gather the courage. Well, I got my answer."
She rose to leave.
"Now you can get on your skis and go and try and rescue the train. Off on another adventure all by yourself. I hope you'll be safe. And I hope you write a great story based on it. But don't think that you're doing it for anyone other than yourself." She left. Tom sat there, staring after her, his hand in his pocket, idly fingering the ring.
Chapter 30. The dining car was full of hungry passengers for breakfast, and Roxanne watched worriedly as the supplies in the kitchen dwindled rapidly. The food in the lounge car had been exhausted the night before, and tempers were already starting to flare, keeping her busy as she put out each fire using all the good humor and diplomacy she could muster. There were a number of infants on board, and as diapers and milk started running low, too, their cries, which ran the length and breadth of the train, put everyone further on edge. Father Kelly finally found the courage to hold a prayer service in the lounge car, and it was well attended by all faiths and denominations, even a few agnostics who were looking for solace. The priest was a little rusty and stumbled at times, but his effort was sincere, and people came up to him afterward and thanked him for lifting their spirits. He confided to Agnes Jo, who'd helped him during the service, that it was the best he'd felt in years, and it actually made him reconsider his retirement. When Higgins wasn't consulting with the train crew on how best to conserve fuel and power, he went out into the storm and personally checked under the cars for evidence of freezing pipes. When he came back in, it was lunchtime, and over several cups of coffee, he regaled the dining car patrons with stories of the Wild West starring Jesse and Frank James, Billy the Kid, and other desperados. Not only the children, but adults listened to these tales with wide-eyed awe. He also told the story of legendary Pullman porter John Blair, who practically single-handed saved an entire trainload of passengers caught in a forest fire in Minnesota in the late 1800s.
"They were in pretty desperate circumstances," said Higgins, "because there's nothing worse than fire. You put fire up against snow,
He motioned out the window. "And I'll take snow every time. May not seem like it, but we're pretty lucky on that score."
Roxanne smiled in appreciation of the point Higgins was making and poured him another cup of coffee. Agnes Jo had been staring out the window of the dining car for quite some time. When Roxanne asked her what she was looking at, the woman pointed at something that Roxanne had to squint to see through the falling snow.
"It's Christmas Eve, you know," said Agnes Jo.
Roxanne nodded.
"You're right, honey. And when you're right, you're right."
A bit later, Eleanor came into the car and joined Agnes Jo and Roxanne. They were looking out the window, and Eleanor followed their gaze. Two men, heavily clothed, were struggling to bring something covered in a tarp into the train.
"What's going on?" asked Eleanor.
"You'll see," said Roxanne.
As the first man came back on board, hefting his end of the load, she saw that it was Barry, the sleeping car attendant. The tarp had fallen off the object he was carrying, and Eleanor saw that it was a stunted pine tree that had been growing on one of the slopes. Most of the snow had been shaken off outside, but hard clumps still clung to its branches and the pine's skinny trunk. As the second man climbed aboard, his hood fell away and she gasped, for it was Tom.
"Christmas deserves a Christmas tree," he explained. "Actually, it was Agnes Jo's idea."
They set it up in the lounge car on a hastily fashioned base, and children came and decorated it with anything they wanted. After an hour's time, the little pine was truly beautiful, or at the very least, interesting, having been strung with everything from fake jewelry to bubblegum baseball cards hung with rubber bands to plastic action figures to a long strand of tinsel that a woman had brought with her for a family Christmas in Albuquerque. Several of the children made a big star from paper and glue, colored it a shiny silver, and hoisted it on top of the tree, which was an easy enough thing to do since the tree was only about 4 feet high. Yet to the folks trapped on the Chief, it was a thing of breathtaking beauty, bubblegum cards, action figures, and all. Tom had sat with a hot cup of coffee and watched as the fabulous holiday tree overcame its modest origins.
"It's beautiful."
He looked up. Eleanor was gazing at the tree and then glancing at him. He nervously fingered his coffee.
"Well, takes people's minds off things. And it's nice to hear a kid laugh right now."
"Mind if I sit down?"
He motioned to the empty seat.
"I thought you'd be gone by now," she said.
"Yeah, well, sometimes plans, if not people, change."
"How have your plans changed?"
"I decided not to go. I decided to stick it out here. One for all and all for one."
She sat back. "I have to say I'm surprised. I didn't think anything I could possibly say..." Her voice tapered off. He finished for her.
"Could get through my thick head?"
He smiled weakly.
"Look, Ellie, I just decided that it would be better to stay here and help. By the time I got to the ski resort, if I got to it, the storm would probably be over and the cavalry arrived."
He paused and then added,
"And if not, well, then better to be here too."
Their eyes locked for a long moment, and then he abruptly stood up.
"Where are you going?" she asked. "I've got some things to take care of, long overdue."
A few minutes later, Tom stopped in to tell Lelia his decision on marriage was a no.
"I really like you and care about you, but I'm not going to marry you and have 8 kids. I hope you understand."
She didn't look like she understood at all. Tears streamed down her face and she clutched at his arm.
"Isn't there anything I can say or do to change your mind? We seem so right for each other."
He shook his head. "I don't love you, Lelia, and I'm pretty sure if you think about it enough, you're going to see that you don't love me either."
"It's just that we've been together for so long."
"Complacency doesn't equal love."
She sniffed into her handkerchief and said in a trembling voice,
"I don't know. Maybe you're right."
At that moment, Cristobal emerged from her bathroom and looked at them both.
"Cristobal?" Tom said, clearly surprised. "Am I interrupting something?" the young man asked. "No," said Tom as he shot a stern glance at snuffling Lelia, "but apparently I am."
She looked at him innocently.
He's been helping me through these trying times. And he gives a wonderful pedicure and back massage.
I'm sure he does. He looked at Cristobal. Ciao.
Tom left and walked down the hall, more relieved than he'd been in a long time, now that Cuppy the Magic Beaver was no longer bearing down on him. In a way, he felt sorry for Cristobal, but he was a big boy. One positive, if surprising, event had occurred. All the items that had been stolen on the chief, and many of the items that had been taken during the trip on the Capital Limited, had been returned to their rightful owners. No one had seen anything, and no one could explain why the thief had experienced such a dramatic change of heart. Roxanne and Father Kelly simply put it down as a Christmas miracle. After dinner, which was served with red and white garnishes in honor of the holiday, everyone was asked to gather in the lounge car. As people arrived, they were surprised to see that a mock stage of sorts had been set up at one end of the car. Max served as the master of ceremonies, whipping the crowd into a mass of expectation before pointing at the stage and calling out, "Do I hear something? Do I hear a special something coming?" All attention was riveted on the stage when a puppet appeared there, and a child screamed out excitedly,
"It's Cuppy the Magic Beaver!"
And then another little boy called out,
"And there's Petey the Pickle!"
And then Sassy Squirrel and Freddy the Futon joined their famous friends on stage, and the good times began. Working the hand puppets from behind the stage were Lelia and Cristobal. Lelia always carried the puppet characters with her in case she ran into any children. She often gave them as gifts. She did all the voices perfectly, switching from a piece of furniture to a pickle to a woodland creature with the smoothness of a true professional. During a break in the proceedings, Cristobal whispered to her,
"I've never been more honored in my life."
They shared a kiss off stage, while Sassy and Cuppy were bopping each other in the head on stage as all the children and even the adults roared with laughter. Santa arrived precisely on schedule, played by Burly Barry wearing a proper Santa suit, which was kept on the chief for just such occasions. The role of Santa was so popular, in fact, that Amtrak employees routinely fought, gambled, bribed, and lobbied during the year to play the lead role each Christmas. Gifts were dutifully handed out by Santa's elves, played by Tom, Eleanor, Max, and Misty. The passengers contributed the gifts from gift-wrapped presents they'd brought with them. Everyone participated with good grace and humor, and the children were happy and laughing, which relieved the adults' tension immensely. Father Kelly, again with Agnes Jo's aid, led them all in a prayer and a Christmas mass of sorts. The minister who'd married Steve and Julie had been asked to participate, but he had refused and stayed in his compartment. Steve and Julie were not seen much. Apparently, they were not allowing even an avalanche to put a damper on their honeymoon, and who could blame them? The boys' choir sang Christmas carols with Roxanne, and everyone joined them, giving it their best. On this occasion, it seemed that everyone's voice possessed a sweet melody. As the night deepened and little mouths started yawning with increasing frequency, folks said their goodnights and strangers slapped each other on the back, declaring it a very fine Christmas Eve. Then they went off to sleep. Eleanor and Tom went with Roxanne to settle the choir down. They were about to leave when one of the boys called out to her. She sat next to the little boy whose name was Oliver.
"What's up?" asked Roxanne as Tom and Eleanor stood next to her.
Oliver's eyes seemed as big as his whole body. He had a voice that could charm and delight the meanest soul on the planet, and he was usually a happy-go-lucky sort. But now he looked worried.
"Patrick said there's no God."
Roxanne gasped.
"What? Patrick, you get yourself over here, boy."
Patrick came up in his striped pajamas and glasses. He was one of the older boys, tall and lean, with a very confident manner. He read constantly and was gifted academically. Roxanne towered over him and put her hands on her substantial hips.
"Explain yourself. Why'd you tell him that?"
All the other boys poked their heads over their seats to watch and listen. Tom and Eleanor exchanged glances.
"It's a simple process of elimination, an evolutionary cycle, really."
He adjusted his glasses as though a very youthful professor addressing his class.
Come again? Well, first there was the tooth fairy. You lose a tooth, you put it under your pillow, and the next morning the tooth is gone and there's money in its place. Most kids discover that's a myth when they're 5 or so, although I, of course, learned it much earlier.
You're 10 now, Patrick, said his brother Tony, and you still put your teeth under the pillow. That's because I want the money, Tony, not because I still believe.
Patrick turned back to Roxanne.
And then you had the Easter Bunny, another falsehood that's discovered perhaps around age 7. Next up is Santa Claus. That fellow who played him tonight, for example, wasn't that one of the train...
Roxanne eyed the younger children, who looked ready to cry at what Patrick was about to say.
Let's move on, Patrick,
she interrupted,
and let's get right to God. Very well. If there was a God of good, then why would he let something like this happen? We're supposed to be home right now, spending Christmas with our families. Instead, here we are in the middle of a snowstorm, running low on fuel and food. How could a God, if he existed, allow such a thing?
Despite his confident presentation, Roxanne sensed that Patrick was as scared as the rest of them and was really hoping she'd explain why there was a God rather than agree with him there wasn't. She set Patrick down next to her and cradled Oliver on her lap.
Now the problem with your reasoning is that you're assuming our being stuck here is a bad thing.
Patrick adjusted his glasses.
Well, isn't it? Not wholly, no. Let's consider it. Let's look at the facts. What happened tonight? The snow fell harder and the kitchen ran out of food. Besides that...
Oliver spoke up.
We celebrated Christmas Eve and opened presents. That's a good thing.
We could have done that with our own families, countered Patrick.
True, said Roxanne. But would your families be scared and hungry? And would they be in a strange place with people they don't know?
The boy thought about this.
Well... No. But the passengers on this train are, right? They really don't want to be here because this isn't their home, right? They want to be with loved ones, family.
Right,
said Oliver enthusiastically.
But that's my point exactly, said Patrick.
No, if I remember correctly, your point was how can there be a God if such a bad thing could happen? And I'm questioning whether it's a bad thing at all to have a bunch of people who don't know each other, who are scared and hungry and wanting to be any place but here for Christmas, spend the evening together and have so much fun that they're laughing and singing along and giving away presents they'd gotten for their own family to people they don't even know.
She looked at Tom and Eleanor.
You two had a good time tonight, didn't you?
Eleanor smiled at the children.
It was one of the best Christmas Eves of my life.
Well, I guess you have a point there, conceded Patrick.
Tom added,
Maybe God made sure you'd be on this train so that you could sing and make scared people forget about their troubles for a while by listening to some beautiful music.
That's another good point,
said Oliver excitedly.
Yes, it is,
agreed Patrick.
You see,
said Roxanne, as she tucked Oliver in and then led Patrick back to his seat.
It's often said that God works in mysterious ways. You have to really think about what he's trying to do. You can't be lazy and believe in God. He doesn't make it that easy. It takes spirit and faith and passion to really believe. Like most things worthwhile in life, you get back what you put into it. Only with faith, you get back a lot more.
She helped Patrick back into bed and covered him up.
Any other questions?
She asked.
Oliver raised his hand.
Just one, Miss Roxanne.
All right, what is it?
Can you take me to the bathroom?
Later that night, Tom and Eleanor stood side by side staring out the window at the snow.
Well, said Tom, it's almost Christmas, and I don't hear anything stirring, not even a mouse.
Right now, I'll take a FEMA rescue team over old St. Nick and his reindeer pitter-pattering on the roof.
Where's your adventurous spirit, your romanticism?
I used it all up with you, she shot back.
She touched him on the arm.
Why didn't you go? The truth now.
I forgot to oil my skis.
I'm serious, Tom.
He looked at her.
Ellie, I told myself that I came on this trip to fulfill my dad's wishes. But I really did it because there's a huge hole in my life, and I had no idea how to fill it. It's been there for a long time, actually, and writing for Ladies Home Journal wasn't plugging it. He struggled. But the reason I didn't go out there, he continued, pointing out the window, is because of what you said. You know, all these years I believed you'd walked out on me, that you had abandoned me. I never really saw that it was actually the other way around. He paused. I'm sorry, Ellie. I really am. She slowly reached out and took his hand in hers. He looked around, puzzled. You know, I wasn't kidding. It really is quiet. Too quiet. They couldn't have known, but earlier, the last drop of fuel on the last diesel engine had been used up, and while they were standing there, the backup battery power lights ran out of juice too. The Southwest chief finally fell silent and dark. And then the quiet was shattered by a rumbling sound, and the chief started to shake, and screams erupted from the coaches. Tom and Eleanor looked at each other.
My God, she said. It's another avalanche!
Chapter 31. If there was such a thing as controlled chaos, it was taking place on the Southwest Chief. The current crisis was the imminent threat of another avalanche that would sweep the Chief into oblivion. The plunging snow had hit the right side of the train and piled so high that one couldn't see out the windows anymore. The crushing weight of the snow against the Chief was actually starting to tilt it. The plan in response was simple: total evacuation of the train, which, under the circumstances, was far easier said than done. Yet 341 passengers made their way from car to car until they reached the last coach car, while Amtrak personnel counted and recounted heads and searched every nook and cranny on the train so no one would be left behind. Covered by blankets, umbrellas, and any other device that could be used against the storm, the long line of people, guided by flashlights and battery-operated lanterns, trekked the short distance to the tunnel. Elderly and disabled passengers and the very young were carried or otherwise assisted. The Christmas spirit must have spread its magic, because stranger helped stranger. The physically fit assisted the disabled. No one complained or fretted about his or her place in line or duties assigned. Flashlights, lanterns, water, blankets, pillows, first aid kits, whatever food was left, and any article that could conceivably come in handy was carried off the train. The only complaint came from the engineer, who blamed himself for not backing the train into the tunnel while he still had fuel, and now he didn't want to leave his post. After Roxanne and Higgins spoke to him,